A new book by history professors Dinah Remy Berry and Callie Nicole Gross adds a level of depth and detail to American history that has long been ignored. Titled A Black Woman's History of the United States, the book begins before 1619 and ends in present day. In the introduction, Callie wrote, African American women's history is marked by the ways that we have marched forward against all odds to effect sustained change individually, locally, and nationally. Here to tell us more about some of that history, Dinah Remy Berry, professor of history at the University of Texas. Hi, Dinah.
Hi there.
And Callie Nicole Gross, professor of history at Rutgers. Callie, nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Sure, Dinah. So you choose an interesting way of organizing the timeline for the book. You write in the book, though there are many points where the book's organization is aligned with traditional historical periodization, we have endeavored to use a timeline most significant to Black women's experiences. So just so our audience can understand, can you give us an example of a significant moment for your timeline, for a Black woman's timeline, that maybe doesn't necessarily intersect or mirror a traditional timeline of U.S. history?
Absolutely. One of the first things that we tried to do was think about what impacted African-American women or women of African descent. One of the first key moments for Black women in this country was 1662 and 1663. There was legislation in colonial Virginia and Maryland that said that the status of the enslaved person was defined by the mother. So any babies that women of African descent gave birth to that were enslaved, their children were enslaved too. So that is an important date for African-American women's history, and not a date that's necessarily makes its way into mainstream textbooks.
Callie, in the introduction you write, we refuse to regard Black women's history as purely oppositional or existing solely in combat with gendered racist oppression, yet we cannot deny the effects of its negative impact. So what do we lose by focusing only on Black women's fight against oppression?
I think one of the things that we really tried to stress was Black women's humanity. Mm-hmm. And if we only focus on how they respond to white racism, we lose that vision, right? That Black women, one of the things that is so incredible about this history is that in spite of crippling, you know, racism, brutal violence, you know, poverty, you know, corrupt laws, Black women still manage to find ways to celebrate themselves and their families. They, you know, create businesses, they bring out a culture, they create art, music, literature, they find ways to love, they worship. So we wanted them to be fully human and vibrant through these pages, not only just in responding to white racism.
I have to tell you, I learned so much from this book. You know, African American history is my jam, and I love it. But I learned so much, and I want to share some of these things with folks. I want to talk about Black women before 1619, before the beginning of the American slave trade. So, Callie, the first woman you highlight in the book is a woman named Isabel de Oliveira. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Who is she, and why did you kick off with her story?
You know, she is a woman who was one of the first explorers, and I'm actually going to pass it to Dinah because I think Dinah can really bring this to life in a way that I would not. Go on, Dinah.
Oh, sure. So we did research and worked with some graduate students to try to find whether or not women arrived before 1619. And we were looking for women that we would define as African descent. And she was a woman of African ancestry and Indian ancestry, according to the way she describes herself. And she was in Mexico in the late 1500s, and she went to the mayor of her city and asked to have a petition to protect herself as she traveled on an expedition to present-day Texas and New Mexico. And she was granted the petition, and in that petition she said that she was bound by neither marriage nor slavery, which we thought was very interesting, to say the least, and that she knew that people would be disturbed by her presence as a mulatto woman, as a woman of mixed race ancestry, and she did not want people to think that she was enslaved. So she wanted a piece of paper, and at the end of her testimony she says, "I demand justice." And Dr. Gross and I thought it was really interesting that this book begins one of the earliest women of African descent that we could find that walked on American soil, came here demanding justice, and we close the book with women demanding justice at the end.
Exactly.
Well, what do we know about what happened to Black women who came to North America as part of European expeditions?
We don't know a whole lot. Like I said, this testimony that we have evidence of the journey. We don't know whether or not, and I've said this before, we don't know outside of this record, we don't have a record of her in New Mexico. We don't have a record of her arrival or her impressions along the way. But we have evidence that has survived from others that were on this particular expedition, the Oñate expedition, that they talked about the journey and how difficult it was, how rigorous it was. So we've mapped out and traced the route that people took to just try to have the reader imagine what route Isabel de Oliveira might have taken.
You know, I just want to jump in and say that's one of the things that can make doing work on African-American women so challenging in the U.S. is because history is so primarily based on paper documents, right, archival records. But people have to be in positions and have resources to leave behind those things. And because of sort of racism and oppression, a lot of times you have African-American women all throughout our history not being in those positions, you know, to leave behind that. So this is one of the ways, you know, we have to kind of piece together and sort of tease out and make inferences to really kind of put together a fuller picture that incorporates all kinds of women, not just those who were literate or well-off enough to be able to leave behind paper documents.
My guests are Dinah Remy Berry, Professor of History at the University of Texas Austin, and Professor Callie Nicole Gross, Professor of History at Rutgers. We're discussing their book, A Black Woman's History of the United States. Now, in the book, I'll let whoever wants to take this one. In the book, you note that black women took advantage, those are your words, of the instability caused by the Revolutionary War and the war with Britain, and used that opportunity to petition for their freedom. How so?
They went to court. They found attorneys and people that were willing to represent them, and they claimed freedom because they heard that the rhetoric of the American Revolution was about liberty. They heard their people that enslaved them talking about breaking the bonds of slavery, and black people interpreted that for themselves as breaking the bonds of slavery that they were experiencing. And so they went to court. And they could not really testify, but they had petitions and they had white representatives to go with them. And some of them successfully sued and received their freedom.
Why did women feel safe to turn to litigation during this period?
I think Dr. Gross and I both would say that I don't know that black women have ever felt safe.
Right. Exactly. Did you hear that me? I think I did an audible gasp. No.
That is why I positioned the question that way.
No, it's a great question. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that we see throughout the history is that, you know, they seize whatever's available, right, knowing that they may not be able to get justice using this. But if it's all that they've got, they try to make the best use of it that they have.
Who was someone who was able to successfully petition for her freedom?
Well, Elizabeth Key is one person that we talk about. Mom Bett is another name that people refer to. My favorite, though, is Belinda, who filed a petition decades after having been living in this country. And she actually, there was a number of people that went to the county on her behalf. And we have a copy of that petition. And this is someone who experienced capture at a very young age, about 12 years old of age, in Africa, in West Africa, and was brought to the United States, experienced slavery, gave birth to children in this country, and at the end of her life fought for a petition to become free.
I want to move on to the Civil War. What was the relationship of black women to the Union Army?
You know, it's complicated. They occupied a range of roles. You have women working as spies in, you know, Confederate leaders' homes. You have women, you know, working as nurses, as cooks, you know, who are helping, taking care of, you know, uniforms. And then you have, you know, women like Harriet Tubman, like doing all, you know, serving, you know, as a spy and also leading folk in battle.
In the book, you highlight the story of Mary Bowser. She's kind of incredible. Can you tell that story for us, Dinah, maybe?
Yes, and we have a colleague, one of Dr. Gross's colleagues at Rutgers University, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, is doing work on her.
Oh, yeah. But she's been a guest on the show, friend of the show.
Oh, good, good, good. So Mary Bowser was, she was able to infiltrate the Confederacy as well by getting into the homes and getting information about what Confederate troops were doing, and to disguise herself in similar ways that Harriet Tubman did. Her story is incredible. And we also talk about another woman named Mary who, you know, on a less global level, was protected all the jewels of her family when the white plantation was being raided by Yankee troops. The white women on the plantation asked her to keep the family jewels and possessions in her apron. And when the troops came through and they were tearing up the house looking for the family possessions, she says, "They didn't even glance at me a second time. Little do they know that a little black girl was holding all the family possessions." So there's stories about that that allow us to tell the story of the Civil War in a much different way, because there's a different perspective when you now have these new stories here.
As more and more people were able to escape from slavery, they began to form communities of their own, and one was called the Dismal Swamp. What do we know about the Dismal Swamp?
That was a place for generations that African Americans would go to hide. Runaway enslaved people went there because they'd prefer to live among the snakes and the alligators and in very unhealthy environment than to live in enslavement. And they had communities that we call maroon communities, where they lived in isolation, and they survived and spent decades there. This was a place that people did not necessarily want to go to, but they often were uncovered, and some of these regions weren't even on maps at the time. So the Dismal Swamp was a space of freedom for African Americans during the entire period of slavery, and a place that people tried to escape to during the Civil War as well.
And physically, where was it?
North Carolina and Virginia.
My guests are Professor Dinah Rami Berry and Callie Nicole Gross. We're talking about their new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States. In the book, you also include women from the LGBTQ community. And one woman you profiled was Mary Edmonia Lewis. She was born free in New York in 1844. She became a renowned artist. Why was her story important to include?
You know, Edmonia was important to include because just to really stretch out the arc of the existence of black queer women in our history. So she was an artist. She, you know, chose, you know, she dressed in this sort of gender nonconforming way. Mm-hmm. She was engaged in relationships with women abroad. She was just a phenomenal figure. And we wanted to include her to begin to sort of sketch out and provide a history that shows the diversity among African American women and the ways that they found, the ways that they managed to live.
And in chapter 6 is titled Frances Sex and the Dawning of the Black Woman's Era, 1876 to 1915. Frances' story is really a tough one. Why did you want to dedicate this chapter to her?
You know, that chapter also, and this actually ties back to your earlier question about changing sort of the timeline. Mm-hmm. Typically, when we teach African-American history or even, you know, really U.S. history, we begin with 1877 because that's with the collapse of Reconstruction. And so what I wanted to sort of do, even by just sort of moving it to 1876, is to really show the importance, even just the 1 year, right? Because this is the year where Frances meets this end. Frances Thompson is a woman who earlier, a decade earlier, goes to testify against outrages she suffered during a race riot in Memphis. She was hounded by police after for that, and she was constantly being accused of various crimes, whether it was like running a bawdy house, you know, being a prostitute, selling like, you know, hoodoo bags, to finally being accused of being a man. And so even though she maintained that she was of double sex, she was arrested and subjected to 4 invasive medical examinations, and these white doctors say that she is, you know, unquestioningly a man. So she's arrested and, you know, imprisoned and forced to labor in men's clothes and, you know, as a washerman and on a chain gang. She survives but, you know, dies 3 months after her release. But I highlighted her because, again, it shows that we have this breadth of experiences in African-American history. And the fact that Frances chose to live as a woman in the late 19th century is phenomenal and something that we cannot overlook.
One of the things that it was interesting in the book is this idea that during wartime, there were interesting avenues of opportunity for Black women to take advantage of and to use. Did that hold true? I mean, we talked about the Revolutionary War, we talked about the Civil War. Did that hold true for the World Wars and Vietnam?
You know, it does to some extent. So when these wars erupt, it definitely opens up different kinds of opportunities. Certainly, I think in World War II, we have kind of a watershed for Black women in terms of being able to occupy manufacturing jobs and playing different sorts of roles. It's also one of the first times that they serve, right, as a colored, you know, women, the Women's Army Corps. They have the sort of Black wax. Mm-hmm. So it does open up opportunities in this sense, but as soon as these wars end and these soldiers return, I mean, they lose a lot of ground almost right away.
And when we think about the 60s and the 70s, when you think about notable political or activist groups that were formed by Black women in the United States, what's one that you would want people to learn more about?
Wow, that's a great question. No softballs with you. I'm torn between the Black Panther Party, just because I think most folks tend to know about the party, but I don't know if they know that African-American women were the majority of the folks who were members, and also that they held leadership positions. So there's definitely, that's one of my favorites. The other one, even though it was short-lived, would probably have been the sort of National Black Feminist Organization. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, after trying to sort of work with white feminists, and now you have Black women kind of deciding that they needed, you know, their own sort of organization to try to uniquely address the intersectionality of their identities, right? That they couldn't separate out race from gender or even sexuality. But at the same time, it was sexuality that really sort of fractured the organization, because among them, Black women were contending with issues around homophobia and classism.
And Donnie, you end the book at an interesting place with the woman who climbed the Statue of Liberty on the 4th of July of 2018. Why did that seem like the appropriate final place to end this book?
I think really because it shows women's activism. We started off the book with the woman who wanted to be involved in an expedition, and now we end it with the woman who's fighting for the rights of immigrants. Therese Patricia Okumuro was also an immigrant, 44-year-old woman. She went out there and tried to get as high as she could, but she also was against the current administration and the ways in which immigrants were being treated and about health care. And so we just thought it was a great way to show the activism that's part of the arc of African-American women's experience. People like Bree Newsom would be included mm-hmm. in that because of her climb on the flagpole in South Carolina. They had to take down the Confederate flag. So we thought there was a theme, and we hope that people can see this throughout the book, that Black women are often leading these movements, but they've not necessarily received the recognition for doing so.
You will learn something if you read this book. It is called A Black Woman's History of the United States. My guests have been Professors Dinah Ramey Berry and Professor Callie Nicole Gross. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you for having us.